Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 244. Apologies for the delay in getting this podcast out. I think I originally promised it for last Wednesday, but a bout of laryngitis and a trip to Legoland were the two reasons why this didn't come out earlier, particularly as young St. Anthony recorded this about 10 days ago now, so apologies to St. Anthony and his guest. Before we go on to this excellent guest, I'd like, first of all, to talk about the event which is taking place to mark the 100th anniversary of the passing of Brother Walfred. In addition to Celtic Football Club, who on the 17th, Friday the 17th of April, will be hosting a lunch for the homeless citizens and charities they are supporting in at Celtic Park. And if you want to contribute to that and donate, you can do so by texting CELT, C-E-L-T, 07, followed by £1, £5 or £10 to 770. That's CELT, 07, then £1, £5 or £10 to 70070. You can donate doing that, or you can go online to the Celtic FC Foundation website. In addition to that, to those supporters who are attending the Celtic game midweek against Kilmarnock, there will be a collection taking place for food banks. I think all the Celtic online presence and the Affiliation of Registered Supporters Clubs, the AICASC, the Grave Society, the Supporters Association, the Trust, Uncle Tom Cobley and all, Kano Foundation, Cadell Street, etc., are supporting this excellent idea. And if you are interested in taking stuff along, then ideal stuff to bring along would be sugar, cartons of fruit juice, soup, pasta sauces, tomatoes, all tinned, cereals, tea bags, instant coffee, rice, pasta, tinned meat, fresh, tinned fruit, jam, biscuits or snack bars. So remember, in the next few days when you're doing your weekly shop, if you've got a few pennies, pounds to spare, pick up a few extra bits and pieces, bring it along with you to the Celtic Kilmarnock game, bring it to the Celtic Way and there'll be guys there collecting. So this week is another St. Anthony podcast with a St. Anthony guest, and it is chief football writer at The Sun, Mr. Robert Grieve. I think I've said with some of the other journalists we've had on in the past, my days of reading newspapers are, or picking up tabloids in particular, but really reading newspapers, although I do read them online, so I suppose I do read newspapers, but not really tabloid stuff, are in the past. I can't really enlighten you on on Robert. Apologies if you're listening, Robert. Pass you over to St. Anthony, who will do a much better job of interviewing the guests than I could have ever done. So this is me passing over, me, Harry Brady, passing over to St. Anthony with him, Robert Grieve.
It's my pleasure to introduce Robert Grieve from the Scottish Sun for the latest podcast. I can confirm that Robert is a genuine St. Mirren fan, unlike some we could mention, and we're going to discuss what's happening between Celtic and St. Mirren and look forward to Friday's game. Robert's got the pleasure of being the Sun's main match reporter, and he gets to travel to Champions League games abroad and was in Brazil for a long period during the World Cup last summer. It's a hard job, but somebody's got to do it. So welcome to the podcast, Robert.
Thanks very much, Steve.
As always in the podcast, we'll start off, what was your first St. Mirren game that you can recall, and who was your first St. Mirren hero?
As I said to you before we started this, Stephen, I actually struggle to remember my St. Mirren game. I actually struggle to remember any games, even recent games and recent places I've been to and whatever. I started supporting St. Mirren in the mid-80s. So you're looking at the 87 Cup final team. It's been the team in that era that I started watching St. Mirren. As I say, games I can't really remember any that stick in my mind as the first game going to. I remember being at St Mirren Park or Love Street, obviously, in a game that we played Dundee United. This is a, you asked me to for a game that's stuck in my mind, and this one sticks in my mind. We're playing Dundee United, and it was late in the game, and it was a draw, it was nothing each.
Mm.
And the game was just about finished. Hamish McAlpine picked up the ball, and Frank McGarvey went up to him, just to kind of stand in front of him. And Hamish McAlpine put, I think he swung for Frank McGarvey, and we got a penalty. So we didn't get a penalty, and we won the game. And everyone was leaving the ground. We're just about heading out the door. Usually stood in the North Bank area of Love Street, but for some reason, because we were leaving the ground. We're behind the goals, behind the goals, high up in the terracing, and Frank McGarvey gets banjoed basically by Hamish McAlpine, and so we got a penalty. We won the game. I can't remember my first game. That wasn't my first game. I must have been about 12 or 13 by that point.
What about heroes then? Who would have been the first hero?
I was a mascot for St Mirren, Stephen. Oh. In 1987, before St Mirren won the cup, my favourite player who I got my picture taken with was Campbell Money, who was obviously the goalkeeper. At that point, as a kid, I kind of sometimes played in goals, and Campbell Money was my favourite player. But I think generally, if I look back at that team, Frank McGarvey was someone I always loved watching. Fantastic player for St Mirren in the spells he had there, but Campbell Money's actually the player I got my picture taken with.
Mm-hmm.
He was a player I chose to be as my favourite player.
He was in the Scotland pool at the time. He's a good goalkeeper.
I think he was in loads of squads, yeah, but never got a cap.
Obviously, with Leighton and Gorham being there, it's my best.
He was kind of well down the pecking order, but he was such a brave goalkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
I remember telling him, and I know Campbell Money now quite well, and I remember telling him a number of years ago now, that he was my favourite player as a kid, and I was a mascot one day when I was 11, and he couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe it, you know. But yeah, Cameron when he was a fantastic.
You mean he didn't remember you?
He didn't remember me, no. I've got the picture evidence right enough I could show him.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, Cameron when he was a great goalkeeper, I thought.
So 87 Cup final obviously was a big thing for St Mirren, and you know that's a wonderful event in St Mirren's history. But just to go back a year before that, the Celtic won the league at Love Street. Were you at that game? Did you have a split?
I wasn't, no. I got asked about that all the time, actually. And I actually don't know why I wasn't at the game. Because that was at the time I pretty much went every week. I don't know if it was just because it was Celtic or because it was such a big game. I didn't go to it, but I didn't know. I wasn't at that game.
Tell you a funny thing about that day, in the old Love Street, as you said there, that obviously it's St Mirren Park, but everybody refers to it as Love Street. There was the big end at the Caledonia Street end,
mm-hmm.
was a traditional away support where mm-hmm. Celtic fans went, right? But the Love Street end, the beauty of it was there was no segregation. And virtually every time that I ever went to Love Street, we always went in there and you would be standing next to St Mirren fans and they'd have their kids there, and there was never any bother. And the one thing I always remember is that when Celtic won the league that day, that there was a sort of a wee lap honour, if you like, and a lot of the St Mirren fans in the shed, is it a North Bank you referred to?
Yeah.
In the St Mirren part of the shed, where there was a wee bit of segregation between the two sort of rival yeah. sets of fans,
yeah.
stood and applauded Celtic because they won the league that day, which I always thought it was a great gesture for them, because obviously they might easily just say, oh, here we're off. But a lot of them actually stayed and clapped Celtic for winning the league that day.
Well, I think people talk about that winning team collapsing that day. And I don't know, I wasn't there. And if I was, I would have been very young anyway. But I think Celtic was just so devastating, weren't they?
Was that famous goal, the one that starts with Danny at the back and it goes to Paul McStay, Roy Aitken, and next time McLeod runs down the wing, the ball's in the net.
Yeah.
And I think within maybe 10 seconds, 5 touches of the ball, and it was in.
There you go.
But I've met a few Hearts fans in my time at work beside, and they hate St Mirren with a vengeance, and it all goes back to that day. And my point to them is, St Mirren had nothing to play for. That doesn't mean to say they lay down to Celtic, because if you finish mid-table and you've not got any anything to play for, then it must be difficult. But the whole thing about that day is, all Hearts had today was keep a clean sheet.
Yeah.
And nothing each draw would have given them the title, so fate was in their hands.
I think if memory serves me right, I've been written about this in various anniversaries over it. I think that Hearts have had a Stonewall penalty turned down early in the game. There, Craig Levine, I think, was ill, or
he missed the game.
There's various things that went against him, but you're right. It was in their hands and they blew it, didn't they? But you're right. I remember watching St. Mirren games and Hearts games, and they're always ferocious matches between the teams, and it stemmed from that. I think after that, in the early 90s,
it was a real needle.
It was always a game as a fan you would look forward to because it was always really competitive. And you're right, it stemmed from the bad blood, which probably still exists today. I think Tony Fitzpatrick a year or so ago spoke about it. It must have been one of the anniversaries of it, and he was criticised by one of the Hearts players at the time and how St Mirren had laid down. So it's clearly stuck in their minds, but I really generally don't think it would have made any difference who Celtic were playing that day.
What not many people would appreciate either is early on in the season, before Hearts went in that big long winning run, the last team to beat them in the league was St Mirren, and it was 6-2 at Love Street.
Is that right?
So at that 4-goal margin probably cost them the league rather than anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm sure McGarvey scored, he either got 3 or 4 that day. Because nobody could believe that Hearts could get a result like that and then go, I think they went something like 28 matches unbeaten. I mean, it was a wonderful record. To avoid defeat in that length of time.
Were you at that game?
At Love Street? Oh, aye. Yeah. I wasn't the only part. It spoiled it that day because I wanted the team to do a real lap on her, right? And you can understand why people ran in the park, and certainly wasn't hooliganism, it was just pure joy, but it spoiled it a wee bit because we were further back in the terracing, and as I said, I was in the Love Street end that day, and a lot of guys stayed and applauded Celtic, which always sticks in my mind as being a great gesture at the time.
There's a great story, I don't know if it's true, that Cameron Money was meant to play, I think, that game before the game became ill or got injured, and that Jim Stewart, who's basically on his second pie, he's sitting in the stand at 2:45, get told he was playing. And I don't know if that's just myth.
That's the kind of things that are normally believable.
But you can just imagine he was sitting there on his tracksuit eating a pie and having a bovril and get told he was playing next minute, he's lost his goal.
I've got a story that day about the late Tommy Burns. My dad was a Celtic pools agent, and he went up to Parkhead roughly about lunchtime to pay his pools. And I was sitting in the car waiting on him, and the next thing, the Celtic team came out to go into the team bus. Now, about 6 months previously, Tommy Burdens had been down to the Knights Club in Renfrew for a charity thing. It was a presentation thing, so that you get somebody famous and you get it in the paper and that kind of thing. I can't remember what the charity was for. It was too far back. But anyway, because Tommy had came and given up his time, the guys down there gave him crystal glasses and were a macro. And as luck would have it, one of them dropped it, right, and the glasses broke, so they had to take it back to Matt. Anyway, that was quite funny on the night that these glasses broke. So Tommy Burns was presented with these glasses, and my dad got to meet him. Tommy Burns was a total gentleman. So we're standing outside Celtic Park as the team are coming on the bus, and there's a few odd group of fans there just to say, good luck, boys, and that kind of thing. And Tommy Burns came out, and my dad says, how is the crystal glasses, Tommy, the ones that we broke, right? And I'm not saying Tommy knew my dad for Adam, but he looked across and he went, they're fine, mate, I'll be drinking champagne at the night. And I don't know if that was bravado on his part, or he truly believed, or whatever it was, but it goes to show how somebody somewhere amongst the Celtic players that day at least had a bit of belief. And certainly they went for it for broke, because we're 4-0 up at half-time,
yeah,
weren't
they? Yeah.
So moving on a wee bit, the great St Mirren team of the period started with Alec Ferguson. And it's rather ironic that in his CV, St Mirren's the only team that sacked Alec Ferguson.
It's incredible when you think about it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before my time, I mean, it was the 70s, obviously, but it's incredible. I think, by all accounts, they came up with a list of misdemeanours. Mm. There's a handful or a dozen or so misdemeanours that he was guilty of, or allegedly guilty of, including swearing at the club secretary and stupid things like this. It's staggering to think that Sir Alex Ferguson, as we know him now, was a manager of St Mirren, the whole Fergie's Furies and everything like that. I'm too young to remember it, but it must have been incredible to be a St Mirren fan.
Some team at the time.
With that young team, that up-and-coming young team. They won the first Division Championship and then all of a sudden he goes to Aberdeen. It's incredible. I think a lot of St Mirren fans, I think, look at Aberdeen and look at the story and look at what happened at Aberdeen thinking that could have been St Mirren.
Mm-hmm.
I think they look at the players he took to Pittodrie and the job that he did there, and they almost wish, or they almost think that could have been them. Who's to know? Obviously Aberdeen are a bigger club, obviously from a city, but St Mirren at that time, well, I think the potential was there. So who knows? But you're right.
It's worthwhile pointing out. This was a different time in football because you didn't have freedom of contract.
Yeah.
You held on to the players. Basically, if you didn't want to sell, they had to stay.
Yeah.
Whereas these days, even teams like Celtic now, you get a player like Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah.
And as soon as he gets into that last year of his contract, you know that he's got to go because he can't afford to let his contract run down.
Yeah, it's clearly changed days. But then, is it such a bad thing? I mean, your clubs back then. Up until Bosman, who you say they held on to players' registrations and they basically had all the power.
Mm.
You had stories, the Dundee United stories, of players signing 10-year contracts or 2-year contracts with an 8-year option, you know, that sort of thing, in the side of the club. So I think that change wasn't necessarily a bad thing. But you're right, it's totally different now. It's so much more in the favour of the player. If you're a good player, then you hold all the aces.
Mm. The guy who was maybe the brightest light in that St Mirren team was Tony Fitzpatrick. He was a captain. And Graeme Spears did a wonderful story this week in the Glasgow Herald. Anybody who's on Twitter, it was all over Twitter. And I think some people wonder why Fitzpatrick was one of the guys that didn't quite reach his potential that he could have been. But I don't think we appreciate the pain that man
went through. Real tragedy, wasn't it?
For anybody who doesn't know, he had a wee boy, Tony Jr., and for 2 years, the wee fellow had a bad illness and was basically dying in front of them, and they were constantly having to go to the sick kids hospital. And honestly, I can't tell you how emotional I felt reading that. And you think, it's hardly surprising that he didn't achieve what he might have achieved if things had been a wee bit different.
Absolutely. I read the piece and thought the same thing. Stephen, it was. There's been a lot of coverage with a lot of articles on Tony recently because he's brought out his book. And I think it's terrific. Yeah, I know Tony well, and he's a real gentleman. But you think, I wasn't aware of that story. Growing up as a St Mirren fan in the 80s, watching Tony, he became St Mirren manager a couple of times, and I didn't know that until very recently that's what had happened. And it was real sorrow for him to deal with.
I knew his son had died, but I thought it might have been in more sudden circumstances. But he shielded it very well because the 2 year thing is happening. Yeah.
You're right, though. He was a fantastic player. I mean, I think the time I remember, like say that keeps talking about that 87 team. He was nearing the end of his playing career by that point. But people talk about him. My dad talks about him. The player he was in the Ferguson team of the 70s. He was a real.
And there was a team
player.
Full of good players. You had McGarvey, Stark, Peter Beard.
Yeah.
You know, Ian Munro. All these guys were like Scotland internationalists at the time. You know, they were a fantastic bunch. So if we can talk about the current Saints setup, now it's not.
Do we really need to?
Well, what I was going to say is off the park. They're looking to sell. Is there any news in with regards? Is there interest in the club?
I don't think there is. No. There's been various parties looking. Or various parties mentioned with a view to buying the club. Late last year, I had a story about the Argentinian consortium who wanted to buy Motherwell. They turned their attention to St Mirren, and that went far enough for Stuart Gilmour on the board to think there was something in it, but it didn't get anywhere near close enough to being completed. There's always been interest. I think St Mirren have been up for sale probably going on 5 years now, and there's been loads of interest, but Stuart Gilmour will tell you that it's never got to the stage where lawyers become involved. And I think until that is the case, he's always very sceptical. Whenever there's certain gentlemen mentioned or certain consortiums who even approached them, until it gets to the stage where there's written contracts going to be signed, I don't think they get very excited. But I think they've been led down various paths and been put off. I think if you were wanting to buy a football club and I can understand why there aren't very many people who do want to do that. But for me, St Mirren's ideal club to buy. There's no debt. They've got their own stadium. They've got a training ground. And they've got a youth system which seems to work. With a bit of investment, I think St Mirren could be, could certainly improve and be a better team than they are now. But in this current climate, how many people want to buy football clubs?
That's hard. It must be hard, sort of trying to separate the chances for the guys that are genuinely interested.
Yeah, I think that has been the problem. I think Stuart Gilmer has become very astute and very accomplished at sorting out the chances from the serious guys. But unfortunately, there hasn't been very many serious guys who have approached the club. And I think that the situation is that the board of directors, who have done an incredible job there, you have to say, I've had my fallouts with Stuart Gilmer down the years, my differences with him, but I don't think you can criticise the job that he's done or any of the board of directors there. The club was doomed at a point when his consortium got control. An Englishman, Reg Brealey, was almost...
That's Sheffield United, man.
Yeah. It was a BBC documentary, I remember, at the time when he was trying to take over. Funnily enough, that's when Tony Fitzpatrick was the manager in his second spell, and it looked like he was really was going to get his hands in the club, and thankfully it didn't happen, or I'm not so sure St Mirren would still be around. But yeah, sure, Gilmer, he makes no bones about it. Him and the directors there, they're desperate to sell up, but that's so much easier said than done. One thing you have to say as well, Stephen, is there maybe has been times where they could certainly make it easier on themselves to sell the club, but they've been very determined that whoever they do sell the club to, that they have to have the best interests of St Mirren at heart.
No, we've seen elsewhere, well, people coming in, you know, certain things that can happen.
We certainly have, and I think it's to his great credit, that not just him, the other board of directors there, the board members there, that they have had that attitude. Because it might have been easy just to basically dust their hands down and move on, maybe even cut their losses. But every year, they're putting their own cash into the club. They're backing it financially, and that must, in this day and age, that must be applauded.
And on the park, I think it's fair enough to say that some of the problems have had been self inflicted. I mean, the sacking Danny Lennon, whether he's sacked or let go, whatever, didn't seem to be the best bit of business, does it, in hindsight?
Very, very surprising the way it worked out. Danny Lennon, whatever you think of him, won St Mirren a major trophy in 2013 with the League Cup. And then within the space of how many months, he's out the door. I was really, really surprising. Ask any St Mirren fan, any journalist, ask anyone, that Tommy Craig was to get that job was really unexpected. I think Danny Lennon would probably tell you he's still quite hurt about the way it was handled. I think what happened was inevitable. I don't think, in terms of it not working, I don't mean that as any disrespect to Tommy Craig, who I've got a lot of respect for. In terms of a coach, he's been around for such a long time that you can't have anything else other than respect for the man.
He was always a coach.
But he wasn't cut out, exactly, yeah, Stephen. Yeah. He wasn't cut out to be a manager in my eyes. I don't think he'll be a manager anywhere else again. So for me, it was no surprise when it didn't work. And they've now gone down the road with Gary Teal. And unfortunately, unless things change very dramatically very soon,
is it too late to get somebody in permanently to maybe get a wee lift?
Yeah, I think they've gone beyond that stage now. I think they've given Gary Teal the reins until the end of the season, and I'd be very, very surprised if they change it now.
If you were the chairman, would you gamble with Jimmy Calder, would, or somebody that's been there maybe? And
Not now, Stephen, to be honest with you. I think they've made their bed. Listen, I've got to be honest with you, I've got a lot of time for Gary Teal.
Well, it's not a criticism of him.
Yeah, exactly, that's what I was going to say. It isn't a criticism of him. I think his inexperience hasn't helped. I would have liked to have seen them maybe appoint somebody, if they're going to bring in somebody like Gary Teal, to give him a bit of a hand, give him a bit of experience there to lean on, and they've not had that. But in all honesty, for me the decision to sell Kenny McLean in January to Aberdeen for just £225,000, I think it was, that has been the decision which, if St Mirren are relegated, is the one that they'll come back to.
Well, he played against Celtic a few weeks ago for Aberdeen. I know Aberdeen get beat 4-0 in the end, but he looked good.
Yeah, he's got a real future in the game, if you ask me.
And he was their best asset, wasn't he?
Oh, he was leading. He was almost single-handedly winning St Mirren games at that spell, and he was really dragging the team by the scruff of the neck almost. I don't know how much he was desperate to go, but I did sense at that time when he did let him go that it wasn't going to bode well.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the same week Dundee United get a couple of £1 million for Stuart Armstrong,
mm-hmm.
Gary Mackay-Steven, and St Mirren lost their a player with, for me, arguably as much potential for a fraction of that amount, which didn't strike me as clever business.
No. And it's almost like resignation as well. It's like, we're getting relegated, so let's get what we can now.
Maybe, but then, I don't. I genuinely don't know how much the player how much he drove the situation. He maybe didn't at all, but it just seemed a paltry amount for a player with real potential. Aberdeen will sell Kenny McLean in the years to come and make on their investment without a shadow of a doubt.
So in terms of, what's your hopes for St Mirren then? Do you think they can maybe
My hope is they beat Celtic tomorrow night, 2-0.
Well,
that'll be quite good.
Coming on a week, the end of the season, are you optimistic?
No. In all honesty, I'm not.
Can you see any light at the end of the tunnel? Or?
The light at the end of the tunnel is that they go into the split, they've got 5 games against teams around them.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you think of the split set up, it's got a lot of critics. I think it's fantastic for teams like St Mirren at the bottom end of the table. They go into that 5-game spell knowing that they're playing teams around them.
Mm.
Now, you can argue that it's going to be harder and they might be better playing a team that's mid-table with nothing to play for, but these games are going to be absolutely huge. I think this weekend could actually be a big weekend. I think Ross County and Motherwell play, and if St Mirren lose against Celtic, for talking sake, they could go 10 points behind Ross County.
Oof.
Which, at this stage of the season,
it's hard to see a way out of that.
It would be hard to see them catching them. Maybe 7 points, I think it would be, behind Motherwell. It's going to go probably to the wire, but I think right now St Mirren are looking at 11th place at absolute best.
So that brings us on to the St Mirren Celtic game tomorrow night at New St Mirren Park. What's your hopes for that?
Well, as I say to you, my hope is that St Mirren win 3-0. But
well, they beat us 4-0 about 4-5 games.
I wasn't at that game either, I have to say. That was a couple of days after the League Cup final, when we lost to Rangers. I think it may be a long night for St Mirren tomorrow night, going with recent form. I'd be astonished if St Mirren can get anything for this game, just in the way that they're playing. But listen, who knows? I think Celtic are unbeatable by any stretch of the imagination. But I think if they turn up, I think it could be a long night for St Mirren.
The funny thing about it being a Friday game is I did a bit of research for the book that I brought out there about the 78-79 season. And there's a game that Celtic fans of mine remember fondly, was a Friday night game between St Mirren and Celtic at Ibrox of all places, because Love Street was getting redeveloped.
Yeah.
And at that time we went to the game, the Copeland Road stand was halfway built and Ibrox was a bit of a mess as well, but every time I hear St Mirren on a Friday night I always think back to that game.
Was that the first championship that Big Billy won?
Mm-hmm. 79. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they won it that night.
They didn't win it that. They beat Rangers to win the a few weeks later.
Right.
But Celtic came out of nowhere and came in with a great run near the end of the season. And that's one of the games that the players always look back to and think that that was one of the nights that we thought, well, after we won that game, because St Mirren had a good team at the time.
Yeah.
You were playing at Ibrox. It was probably worse for St Mirren because they weren't playing in their home, mm-hmm. their home turf. And it was an odd situation because not only was Love Street getting redeveloped, but Ibrox was as well. But anyway, we were squeezed into Ibrox that night and Celtic won 2-0. So bringing us on to the Celtic this season, what's been your opinion as a journalist this season and Celtic's progress under Ronnie Dial?
I must admit I've been impressed, very much impressed with Ronnie Dial since day one. I like the guy. I like how he conducts himself. I like the way he speaks. You ask him a question, you get an answer. Very similar to Neil Lennon in that regard. You can ask him anything and he'll tell you what he thinks. It was very difficult for him to begin with. I think that the European exit, both of them, was really, really hard on him. It came too soon for him. And I think at that stage there was real alarm bells. I think there was probably real alarm bells going off inside Celtic Park, in all honesty, at how things were beginning for him. But I don't think there's any doubt that over time, his methods behind the scenes at Lennox Town and the way he's put his stamp on those players has slowly but surely worked. I think Celtic are night and day from the team they were at the start of the season. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that, but you can see his methods getting through to the way they play. They're a fitter team. They hunt teams down now, which initially they couldn't do because I think the players didn't quite buy into what they were asked of, or they were having asked of them. But yeah, I think there's been real improvement. The problem I think Ronnie Dial has got is that the players he's going to lose this summer, it may be another rebuilding job. If he loses Virgil van Dijk, mm-hmm. Jason Denier returns to Man City, that's two of his bigger players. Mm-hmm. And I think that's...
Sadly, that's going to happen sadly, every season.
Exactly.
I mean, one season you lose a Wanyama, the next season you lose Fraser Foster, the next season you lose Van Dijk, that's going to be a...
And that's such a shame, isn't it? Because I think if he could keep some kind of stability there...
And build something
with a young team, then I think he could go from strength to strength.
Mm. Something's definitely happened since the new year because, you know, even the likes of myself up until...
The players have bought into it, Steve. That's what's happened. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I think the players have really bought into it. He's also found
a niche for certain players in the team. I mean, mm-hmm. like, no disrespect to Charlie Mulgrew, he's not a midfield player, but since Beaton's got a run in the team,
Beaton's
everything looks better because he is an actual midfielder.
Yeah, I think he's been a real find this season. He's been one of the real stars in that team for me. I think I was talking this other day in terms of player of the year and who you maybe end up voting for. I mean, Scott Brown again has been fantastic.
Mm.
I mean, you look at other areas of the team and who's performed. Craig Gordon has been what a signing that's proved to be. But for me, Scott Brown has been the real driving force in that team again.
So who would be your vote for player of the year this year then, now that you mention it?
It would probably, well, again, it would probably be between those two players. I was talking about this the other day, and I think the Craig Gordon story is such a fantastic story in terms of this is a guy who thought he was finished, a guy who thought his career was over, and here he is out of the European games. He was fantastic, and I think he's been different class just about every game he's played. But then Scott Brown, I think, has been the real driving force, as I say, in that team. For me, it's a toss up between those two. I've got
Robert Johansson.
I can understand, Stephen, why he gets so many plaudits because of his goals and the way he plays. I don't know. There's something about Stefan Johansson which I don't buy into. I'm not saying I don't like him as a player. He's clearly a talented player, but if you're asking me, Scott Brown or Stefan Johansson, there's no contest. Absolutely no contest.
So. There's been rumours, but certainly no rumours, because Ronnie Dial was talking about it the other day, that Danny Wilson for Celtic. Do you see that being a goer, and do you rate Wilson good enough to move to Celtic?
I'm not so sure, in all honesty. I think there's certainly something in it, there's no doubt about that. He's clearly on Celtic's list, a lengthy list, I'm sure it'll be, but I think he'll definitely be on it. I think Ronnie Dial has spoke quite openly about trying to, I mean, he spoke, didn't he, saying about the vast majority of the Scotland squad were on his list. Obviously, Danny Wilson's not in the Scotland squad, but he's a ball playing centre half, isn't he? He's a player who can come out from the back, left sided, comfortable on the ball, and I think that's very much the mould of player that Ronnie Dial will be looking for. So yeah, I could see him fitting in. He would clearly have to step up. He's been playing Championship football for a season.
I have to say, I was never convinced from even when he was a Rangers player. Like, there used to be guys in my work, Rangers fans, and they would all be raving about him. And any time I saw him, I thought, that boy did he look anything special to me?
I think he reads the game very well. I think he's got a lovely left foot.
Does he get pace?
And he's quick, yeah. Mm. I think he's quick. Is he strong enough? Is he physical enough? Is he a commanding centre half? I don't think he is. But as I say, I think Dial is probably looking for other attributes in his centre halves. It'll be very interesting. I'll be really interested to see what happens in the summer. Ronnie Dial speaking yesterday, Virgil van Dijk himself speaking as well, how he's not even thinking about a move in the summer. I'll be astonished, absolutely astonished, if Virgil van Dijk's a Celtic player for the start of next season.
I think Virgil's been a wee bit, how can I put it?
He's been diplomatic. But
very diplomatic.
But Ronnie Dial also has said he's not going to be sold.
How many years has Virgil got left in his contract? Is it two or one?
I think it's two.
Because if it's two, then you might get another year out of him, but if it's only one, he's got to go in the summer. The board have made that clear.
I don't think it is one, though. I think it is 2 years. I could be wrong.
But as each year passes, the price goes down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is a worry.
If it was a year, then he's away. But I just think he will go. I think it's almost certain. And I was really surprised with Ronnie Dial, with his quotes when he said he won't be sold. That he's almost had a guarantee from Peter Lawwell that he won't be sold. I think when Peter read those quotes this morning, I think he might have been straight on the phone to his manager.
The other thing that happened during the week there was Liam Henderson went to Rosenborg.
Yeah.
Did that surprise you as well?
It didn't. I'm a big fan of Liam Henderson. I have to say, I was pre-season with Celtic
18 months ago
in Germany.
I remember you talking about that.
Do you remember?
He made his debut, aye.
Uh-huh. I can't remember who he played against him. It was almost like a public park. It was like a junior ground in Germany.
I think
somewhere.
We got a couple of humpings out of it.
We did.
That's not the fact that he played well.
You did, yeah. But he did. He was, I don't know, it was just something. It was the same with Van Dijk. He made his debut, and as soon as you saw him, you thought, this boy's a player. This guy's a player. And it was something very similar about Henderson for me. He's just very, very comfortable in the ball. Doesn't seem to panic. And I was really, really impressed with him. I thought he'd have made a bigger impact. I think Neil Lennon brought him in towards the tail end of that season, didn't
but
he?
But Ronnie Dial surprises me because at the beginning of the season, he made a big play for Callum McGregor.
Yeah.
And he did well initially, and then he drifted out a wee bit. But I actually felt that Liam Henderson would have been more Dial's kind of player because he does have that energy, he does have that engine, and he, 1 minute he's defending in his penalty box, the next minute he's up firing shots at goal.
The thing about McGregor was he was a wide player he needed, wasn't it? He very much needs width in his team, and young McGregor gave him that, with obviously James Forrest being injured. I think since Forrest has come back then there's obviously the real hope that he's going to get back to somewhere near his best. Whether he does or not remains to be seen. But you're right, Callum McGregor bust onto the scene and he's got into Scotland squads and he looked like the next big thing. But it was maybe too much too soon.
He'll come back.
Absolutely.
A lot of young boys have a wee sort of dip and then you know that they come back because they're all the better for the experience.
Yeah.
So if we move on a wee bit to the journalist side of the job that you do, you see a lot of football, especially in Scotland. So what's your opinion of the current standard of SPL overall? Has it been a good season, or have you enjoyed what you've watched?
Yeah, pretty much. I think you've got to give Aberdeen, Dundee United a lot of credit for the runs that they've gone on. I can't remember how many games exactly Aberdeen put together, but it was as good as any run that they've had in a number of years.
Well, the whole thing about Aberdeen is, if it wasn't for the head-to-heads, they would be right up there. So it would.
Yeah.
Excuse me a sec. And Aberdeen, as I said, the head-to-heads, if it hadn't been for Celtic winning those games, then they would be much more even. It's almost as if Aberdeen, I'm not saying that the two Aberdeen-Celtic games, Aberdeen were very unlucky.
Yeah.
And then in the third one, you know, Celtic tended to overpower them in the end.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, you could if you wanted to be critical, then you could point to them and how they fell short. In those games against Aberdeen, I think the game at Pittodrie, which the defeat that kind of sparked a run, was it Van Dijk scored stoppage time or the last minute, didn't he, to win the game?
Yeah, beat 10 men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, had that not gone in, then how different it would have been, I don't know. But for me, Celtic are the best team in the league. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think they were always going to win the league. And quite honestly, so they should.
Mm-hmm.
With the squad that they've got, with the money and the resources they've got. Absolutely, they should be winning the league. But again, I think Aberdeen have deserve an enormous amount of credit for at least making it a title race.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's still a title race, you could argue it isn't anymore. But up until that game a couple of weeks ago, Aberdeen were right in it. And fair play to them. I don't think you can, or I think you should give them real credit for that.
Now, the thing about Aberdeen is, losing to Celtic at Parkhead wasn't a disaster. But they draw against Dundee, they draw against St Johnstone, and I think that the other draw against Dundee, their games you really need to be winning.
Yeah, but you're always going to get that, Steve. You're always teams getting consistency, winning consistently throughout a season is always that's why, that's how teams win championships. Mm-hmm. And that's a mentality thing for me. You've got players in that Celtic dressing room right now who know what that's like, who are under pressure every single game to win, otherwise they're in for flak.
Mm-hmm.
And Aberdeen players, Dundee United players, don't have that. Mm-hmm. Don't have that level of expectation on them. Mm-hmm. From their fans, even from their manager, from each other. They don't have that level of expectation on them. And I think, ultimately, that may be what it boils down to. When you get to the last 10 games of the season, it's a mentality thing. If you're right in the thick of it, you've proven you can win however many games, a dozen games or more, in succession, or you can an unbeaten run for so long, then so you know you can beat all the teams. You know Aberdeen know they're better than every other team in the division, bar Celtic. Yet they get to Celtic and they lose. If they win every other game, they would probably still be right up there. So there's probably a mentality thing about it. But again, I'm not going to criticise Aberdeen, Derek McInnes, or any of the players there, because I think they deserve an enormous amount of credit.
Mm-hmm,
for the season that they've had.
Definitely. Now, you're a newspaper man, and at the moment newspapers they've all got dropped in circulations, and they're more into website based news. So since you've became a reporter, do you see a difference in how things have went for the printed news to the electronic?
Absolutely, yeah. There's been a huge difference.
It's almost like if I can say it's immediate news. It used to be like you need to wait the next morning to get your news, but these days.
That's it.
With Twitter and the websites and all these other things, it's a constant moving news schedule.
In a way, it's a good thing. In a way, 10 years ago, if I got a story at 10 o'clock in the morning, I wrote the story and you prayed that
nobody
else would get it, and it was in the paper the next morning. Whereas now, if I get a story at 10 o'clock in the morning, you can think, is this going to hold? Is there a chance this is going to come out elsewhere? Who do I think knows this? Other papers? You wait up, and if you think there's a chance it comes out, you get it on the website within 10 minutes. So that's a good thing. But there's absolutely no doubt that because of that, the job's without doubt changed. You say with Twitter, social media, everything else that comes with it. But it's like every other industry, Stephen, every other industry is adapting. So you just have to. It's a good thing. It's got its good points and it's got its bad points. So you go on, mate.
I know you're on Twitter, but you're not particularly prolific. But no. You guys like Graeme Spears and Keith Jackson, and I find it fascinating each night just seeing what they're saying.
Yeah.
But you couldn't have done that, you know, before. I mean, obviously that they've got their columns in the newspapers and they get their opinions out there. But even just to go onto Twitter and see how they're interacting with different people, it's quite fascinating at times.
Yeah, you mean those guys? I'm not mentioning names, but they'll be. And I don't mean Keith or Graham, but there's some guys who court controversy in print just as they court controversy on Twitter or online.
It's almost like devil's advocate. They're just saying something.
Yeah, they say people things to noise people up. There's guys do that, as I say, guys doing that have done that in columns, newspapers, since the day dot, hoping that it builds up debate and it becomes a talking point and people buy a newspaper. People now do that on Twitter, and as you say, that's not really my bag. I'm on Twitter, and I sometimes tweet about nonsense things. And other times I'll tweet about stories or try and attract people to certain topics or stories that are about. But yeah, you're right. If you want to do that, if you want to tweet 24/7, you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it 24/7 and get a reaction if you want. But I can't actually think of many things worse than sitting on a Friday night at 11 o'clock tweeting folk about...
All sorts.
Yeah.
I can imagine. But Roger Bailey was recently on the site and he commented that he sympathises with the current journalist because he's got so much space to fill.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the day, you had one guy wrote the match report and then the next day a guy maybe wrote a sort of like a follow-up article to who was injured or who scored the goals or whatever. But these days, I mean, like papers like The Record and The Sun, is like 16-page pullets at the weekend. And is it possible that there's overkill?
I'm not so sure if there's overkill. I think there's certainly a need for information. I think there's a thirst for information. You're just talking about Twitter there and how everyone's just looking for little nitbits of information. So if you go to a game and I think everyone wants to know about everything that's happened. And so I don't know so much if there's overkill. You're right though. I was talking to someone about this recently, an Airdrie fan who was talking about when Airdrie got into Europe, in the 90s, they got to the Scottish Cup final. It was against Celtic, wasn't it?
No. I think the reason that they got into Europe was they lost to Rangers, but in those days, yeah, the losing cup.
It was Rangers,
finalist,
wasn't it? It was Rangers. So they got into Europe.
Slavia Prague, was it?
Yeah, I think that's right. They got into Europe, and on the same night, Celtic were playing. I think Rangers were playing. There was basically four European games, Scottish teams in the one night. Mm-hmm. And the four games were on what we call a spread.
Mm-hmm.
The two pages had four games, four match reports on that one spread.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, as you say now, if I go to a Champions League game with Celtic or whoever, you do seven pages in the one game.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas those two pages had four match reports.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, each match report was maybe a dozen paragraphs, big photograph, a big headline, and that was it. And the story was Airdrie last night lost 2-0 to Slavia Prague, or whatever the scoreline was. You know, Celtic last night lost 1-0 to whoever. Rangers last night. It was very, very kind of simple and straightforward.
Just factual, really.
Yeah, just the facts. Because in those days, in all fairness, guys woke up at 7 in the morning, they went to the newsagents on their way to work, and they wanted to, if you weren't at the game, that's how they found out the score.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this day and age, you know the score, you know what happened as it happens. If you're not watching it on TV, you're on Twitter. If you're not on Twitter, it's on the radio. If it's not on the radio, you're on your internet. So everyone knows everything as it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's no doubt that the match report writing has changed. And you're absolutely right, there's so much more coverage to go with every game.
The press are criticised sometimes for not talking up the game in Scotland and for being a wee bit negative. Would you say that's a fair comment or is that unfair?
I think that's completely unfair. Absolutely 100% unfair. If you look at the coverage that Scottish football, for instance, gets on a Monday morning, you buy any national newspaper. You buy the Sun newspaper on a Monday morning. There'll be a 16-page pullout on Scottish football from the SPFL Premiership to the Championship, League One, League Two, the juniors, women's football, you name it. The Lowland League, the Highland League, everything. And it's all, for me, positive coverage of Scottish football.
Mm-hmm.
Free advertising for every club.
Wait, is it fair to say then maybe like the other forms of media then are maybe in the radio are a wee bit more cynical?
But what's cynical? What would you classify as cynical? Everyone's got an opinion. Mm-hmm. If you're on a radio station right now and you're asked about Celtic or you're asked about Virgil van Dijk potentially leaving or Celtic selling players again or whatever, mm-hmm. and you happen to have an opinion about that, does that make it, and you think you're not happy about it or whatever? Everyone's got their own opinion. And it's like anything else as well. If you turned on Radio Clyde right now and listened to their phone in, it would probably be people having a go at people or people criticising someone. Very rarely do people phone up a radio station, if ever, to say, he's doing a great job, or well done. I like that player, or well done to someone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a silent majority, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I think Scottish football gets fantastic coverage. The newspapers every day, stories about Scottish football, and positive stories. All right, you're going to get negative stories, you're going to get things people don't agree with. But you know, I would definitely 100% disagree with anyone who just points to the negativity. You'd have to explain to me what negativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's just sometimes like there's maybe especially on the radio, it's like, oh, we don't have Dalglishes anymore, and we don't have Soonises anymore, and that kind of thing. But it's understand to a point because they were exceptional players at their time. But you know, I think that there is personality players within the game now that maybe don't
I think
talk
you can
about.
Almost look at the opposites. You're talking earlier on about Callum McGregor. Now, Callum McGregor was built up when he makes his debut for Celtic. He gets into the team, he does really well. I think, and if you look back at the coverage at that time, everyone's talking the kid up. Now, is Callum McGregor the next superstar? Is he going to be the next £10 million player to leave Celtic? Maybe not.
Mm.
But there was a real push towards, this kid's great,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's good.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't this kid isn't the next Kenny Dalglish, let's not talk him up, or this kid isn't the next big thing. I think there still is a positive reaction to people want to read good news stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people talk about the press and how you write negative headlines. People want to read good things. I don't go to a game hoping that whatever team's a Celtic game in Europe or a Scotland game, if I'm covering, hoping they lose. That's a complete myth. You sit there hoping for the Scottish team to win because people want to read good news stories, and that's the truth.
Well, we've took up enough of your time, and I just want to thank you for coming along and sharing your views and opinions, and it's been interesting. So all the best for the future with anything that you do.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Okay, pleasure. Job.
Thank you.
So I hope you enjoyed that podcast and interview from St Anthony with real St Mirren fan and Scottish Sun chief football writer Mr Robert Grieve. As I said at the beginning, apologies Robert, but I don't read tabloids, don't really read newspapers anymore. Just get my stuff online, which I suppose some of it is newspapers and blah blah blah. Anyway, so I'm sure you enjoyed that. As I said earlier, we've got some excellent podcasts lined up with guests, a couple in Augusta and a couple of others who, for what they do for a living, it will be towards the end of the season, but some good podcasts lined up. We'll go well beyond 250 and onwards. I know at the beginning of every podcast, I thank everybody for downloading and listening to blah, 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 but genuinely, the numbers of people who download make it worthwhile to do this. It's not just for some navel-gazing fun, and it's actually not to sound like some sort of bad local radio DJ, but it is actually heartening when you get some of the emails you get in thanking you. for doing the podcast. So specifically in the last week, I've got a note of emails from Martin Della, Ian Kerr, Scott, or Scotty12301. And also thanks to Jeb Rover, who helped, because I'm not on Android. And when we had a bit of an issue with the Android app, he was letting me know if it was working or not. So thanks to everybody. Thanks once again for downloading. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. More will be along soon. This is me, Harry Brady, saying good night. Good night. Bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.